Now, back to The Drive with Steve Jackson, live and local on Crystal Clear FM at 103.5 in Santa Rosa and 94.5 in Petaluma.
Welcome back. We are on The Drive on KSRO, and we are going to be talking soon to our next guest, former State Department advisor Aaron David Miller. Aaron, are you with us?
I am, Pete. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Well, speaking of pretty good, let's talk about some things that are not pretty good. We got a lot of tense stuff going on with Iran. It's a question of, you know, who did what? Did somebody fire on the tankers? Was it Iran? Was it a mistake? Who's lying? Who's telling the truth? And what's the next step? Can you share with us some of your thoughts on this whole situation?
Yeah, I mean, we're, I think, headed for a some sort of confrontation, and I'm not sure there's the political space to unwind it. The Iranians, in my judgment, I spent a decade as an intelligence analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, State Department. There are a few slam dunks, but it seems to me, based on the video, which is clear now, the one nation-state actor that's got the intention and the capacity to do this, and remember, these mines, if that's what they were apparently placed above the waterline rather than below, which suggests that the intent was not to destroy and sink these ships, but to send a signal. And the Iranians are reacting. And again, I've got no brief for them. They're a serial human rights abuser and a regional menace. They're reacting to the reality that the administration, for reasons that are not clear, although I think driven largely by domestic politics, decided that it would exit the highly flawed but still very functional Iran nuclear agreement without a plan B, an endgame, or a strategy. And it's part of what I call the great unwinding. And we now find ourselves in the position, you know, poised for the possibility, not the inevitability, the possibility of a significant confrontation with Iran. I don't think that's where President Trump wants to go. I think there may be others in the administration that really do want to use this as an occasion to teach the Iranians a lesson. But it's extremely complicated and I think a very fraught situation for the United States.
Yeah, it's one thing to teach the Iranians a lesson, but there's a huge cost to be paid for that, too. And how much of it are we willing to pay? And how much of a lesson should we teach them? It seems like what they are asking Iran to do now is basically what they had already agreed to in the nuclear agreement that was brokered by President Obama, which Donald Trump immediately just, as you say, tossed out the window, but had no alternative as to how to deal with Iran.
Right. I think what we can say after a year or so passed since withdrawal from the agreement last May is that some of the assumptions of the Trump administration have not proven to be accurate. I mean, a maximum pressure campaign, you know, could work if it was accompanied by incentives, but it's virtually impossible to imagine, at least with the mindset the administration had up until now, that they're prepared to apply pressure in order to get the Iranians back to the negotiating table. I mean, it's a fair argument. The question is to do what? I mean, the Trump administration walked from the agreement and now, quite paradoxically, is demanding the administration, the Iranians, adhere to an agreement that the Trump administration canceled. And we have credibility problems, not only with respect to the intelligence, but in terms of convincing our European partners, even if they believe the intelligence, that this maximum pressure campaign, which could lead to a military confrontation, is a smart thing to do. We don't have many friends or any on this issue. I suppose the Israelis and the Saudis and the Emiratis, but again, for them it's perilous too, because if you do wind up in a shooting war with the Iranians or even an asymmetrical conflict, I don't think the Iranians want to confront the Americans directly, but the Israelis and particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis are exposed and very vulnerable to Iranian sabotage, surface-to-surface missiles, mining, attacks on oil infrastructure. So I would like to think that there is space to draw back, but right now I'm hard-pressed to define exactly what that what that space would be.
Yeah, it's a little tough to envision a situation where we can get a whole lot of people on our side when the intelligence is rather sketchy. We're still trying to figure out exactly what happened. There's a lot of doubt as to whether or not Iran was even responsible for it. And plus, the U.S.'s foreign credibility, for obvious reasons, is pretty much at an all-time low. So it's a little tough to make the case, like, for example, George H.W. Bush did in the first Gulf War, that there's a need for allies to gain to band together to take action against an obvious threat.
Yeah, and, you know, I worked for Jim Baker, who was Bush 41's Secretary of State, and there we had compelling empirical evidence. After all, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and threatened Saudi Arabia, and Bush made a decision that he would not let it stand. Bush 43, for whom I worked as well, had a different proposition. And there I think our credibility has taken a beating. And the shadow of Iraq still looms large over this, because there's no way you're going to convince the Europeans, let alone the Russians and the Chinese, that there's compelling evidence to justify and to warrant an American strike on the Iranians. Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that they did it. We're talking about disabling tankers. They're not American tankers, and yes, freedom of navigation is important, keeping the Straits of Hormuz open, important, and if the Iranians made an attempt to close those straits asymmetrically with mines and submersibles and shore-to-ship missiles, we'd have to basically open it. But there's no compelling case right now to enter an open-ended conflict with Iran based on what the Iranians have done. In fact, I would argue there's a compelling case to try to find a way to avoid military conflict. I just can't see. I see two immovable forces moving toward one another without a whole lot of space for diplomacy.
Yeah, there's never been much love lost between Iran and the U.S. for quite some time, but you're right. I mean, the notion of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which proved to be completely illusory, didn't exactly enhance the credibility in a situation like this, when they say, oh, we have definitive proof that Iran did it, and pretty much everybody else is saying, what definitive proof?
Right, and I think I've worked for Republicans and Democrats and voted for them as well. I think any administration that contemplates putting Americans in harm's way needs to ask at least three basic questions, not just can we do it, and U.S. military can usually deliver, but we also have to ask should we do it, and then not just that, what will it cost, and how do you create an exit ramp given the uncertainties and the unknowns? And that's the real problem. I do believe that one of the more redemptive aspects of this president's foreign policy, frankly, is a continuation of the risk aversion of his predecessor. He's not interested in getting America into new and unwinnable wars. In fact, he wants to get them out of those that for which the standard of victory is never can we win, but when could we leave? Afghanistan's a key example of that. So there is a certain amount of risk aversion, which I think it would take a considerable amount, I think, to convince this president, given the fact that one of the hallmarks of his presidency is this notion of America first, which with respect to deployment of military forces means let's get out of endless wars, as he told Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation in February. So I think that's, frankly, that sort of prudence makes sense, but there's the idiosyncratic sort of reckless side of the administration's policy as well. And how those two things are going to be reconciled right now is, you know, it's just not clear to me.
Well, there seems to be a lot of, you know, just fly by the seat of your pants when it comes to, you know, any sort of policy, but particularly foreign policy in this administration.
Well, there's a lot of, yeah, I mean, look, I've been through transitions from R's to R's, R's to D's, D's to R's, D's to D's, and I think rarely, almost never, frankly, in my 25 years of experience, for what it's worth, as have I seen administrations' foreign policy so deeply politicized, number one, and so oriented or taking its cues from the sort of North Star, which is the Obama presidency. It's almost as if, and every administration wants to leave its fingerprints, its hallmark, its stamp, but never have I seen a urgency and a willfulness to abandon so many initiatives of his predecessor, and without thinking through the costs and the consequences of what that abandonment actually means. So, yeah, it's a very politicized administration. Remember, that's three national security advisors in 2 years, two secretaries of state, and a president who I think, again, I'll remind your listeners, it's not a partisan comment. I voted and worked for Republicans and Democrats. President who basically believes that he understands the world, how to negotiate, and how to deploy American leverage better than any of the experts, his intelligence organizations, and his senior advisors. So I think in a crisis situation, all of those qualities would give me great pause to believe that that the Republic is being guided by a hand that is sure and steady and essentially knows what to do. I hope I'm wrong. I certainly don't want to see the United States engaged in another seemingly unwinnable confrontation a long way away from home whose goals are not clear. I mean, last point, let's be clear, military power is essential, but it's also instrumental. It's a means to accomplish a set of ends, and those ends need to be, to the degree that is humanly possible, thought out carefully so that there's a proportion and a relationship between the means at your disposal to accomplish your goals and the goals that you set for yourselves. And I'm not sure there's a careful calibration about what the purpose and the point of military power, if used against the Iranians, would be. Is it to create cracks and fissures in the regime to eventually see its collapse or fundamental change? Is it to drag the Iranians back to the negotiating table? Or is it just to apply maximum pressure because, you know, being anti-Iran these days is very good politics. But you're in the middle of a, you know, like what clearly is going to be a fascinating struggle for in 2020. And rising gas prices, particularly in the summer, and a lot of money spent in another unwinnable war is not the kind of campaign that any successful politician or hopes to be successful wants to run.
Yeah, and I think one of the points you made is very very telling. Is like, you know, the use of military force or to have a military force is essential. But to me, one of the key things is not only using the military force, but knowing when not to use it.
Right.
And pursue another avenue.
Woody Allen once said that 90% of life is just showing up, but I think he's only partly right. It's 90% of success in life is showing up at the right time, and I think that's true of the use of military force. It's also true of knowing when to engage diplomatically as well, so you can maintain your credibility and don't look weak, or weak on one hand and overly aggressive on the other.
Right. A good thought to leave us with. We have been talking with former State Department advisor Aaron David Miller. Aaron, thank you for calling in. I appreciate your insights. And, of course, we all have an extreme interest in seeing how this is going to turn out.
For sure. And thanks, Pete. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.